Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me. Lucy, if you haven't been blown away.
No, even as we speak, there's terrible winds howling around the place. So it's all quite dramatic. How is it with you?
It's awfully windy. And I have to say, I've been outside with my snips and rescued all the tulips. And I've got them in the house now because they were just being bashed. And I thought, well, there's... that's no good for them. They might as well be adorning my kitchen table. How about you?
Well, actually, my tulips have stood up to it and they're quite strong. But what's happened is what happens often is that my beautiful peonies have come out, two of them, two huge, great big blooms as big as your hand, and immediately were completely smashed by the wind and the rain. So I had them for about 45 minutes, but they were very, very beautiful for those 45 minutes.
It's a sad, sad labour of love, life with a peony, isn't it?
It is, but it is worth it because when they're so wonderful when they're out. I've got lots more hopefuls as well, so you know.
Look forward to those 5 minutes of beauty that you get. Meanwhile, my sweet peas are going great guns, but they're going nowhere near the outside world for a long time, I don't think.
No, mine are still inside, and mine are getting a bit spindly and unhappy. But I think if you put them outside, they're just going to just get devastated.
It is, we might say, very good weather for reading. Have you been doing any reading?
I have. I actually started reading a book that we were talking about last week, The Extinction of Irena Ray. We were talking about it with Toby and about how it's a book about translation.
And a missing person.
And I thought it was
right up my street.
Yeah, and a forest and mushrooms, which is all very much up my street. And it's working on several levels. It's narrated by... it's already translated and the translator works with the person who's written it in their language, but they disagree with them about lots of things. So there's lots of little asides in there and you have to work out who is who. It's very complicated and it's very good fun, but I know exactly what Toby means. I'm reading it and thinking, whew, can I keep up with this? But in a good way, not in a kind of it's vegetables, it's good for me, but just like I feel like my brain's doing a workout. So that's good.
Well, I know what you mean. I have read this week Sleepless Nights by Elizabeth Hardwick, which is, I mean, you might call it essays, classifying it, as Emma McBride points out in her introduction, is kind of pointless. Mm. But I have read paragraphs of such incredible deliciousness and beauty and discernment that I thought I might never write another word. They're just too good. And very interestingly, because this is the TLS's Shakespeare issue this week, isn't it? Lots of fascinating pieces about performance, and we're going to be talking to the author of one of them in a little while. But Elizabeth Hardwick, there's just a very brief moment where she says, I really do prefer just to sit in and read a play, and I can get much more out of it that way. And so not everybody thankfully feels like that, but it was an interesting moment. But what a wonderful book it is. I heartily recommend that you...
what's it called again?
It's called Sleepless Nights.
Okay.
And it has so many things. It's a lot to do with her life in New York, but it's unclassifiable aperçu into the business of living. Let's just put it like that, including an absolutely extraordinary passage, series of thoughts about Billie Holiday, which is just one of the, again, one of the best things I've ever read about Billie Holiday. So there you are. That's a big 5 stars for me. But shall we get on with the business in hand?
Let's get on with the business for podcasting, shall we?
We will. And a bit of Shakespeare. Emma Smith takes a trip to Eastcheap to see Ian McKellen strut his stuff and run a meter on the impact and legacy of the Tokyo trials.
But first, we were at the theatre last week and we are there again because it's our Shakespeare issue and he belongs, despite what Elizabeth Hardwick may tell you, he does also belong on stage. The big new Shakespearean production of the moment is Player Kings, which is Henry IV's parts 1 and 2 adapted into one evening and directed by Robert Icke, and with an excellent cast, not least Ian McKellen as Falstaff. We asked Emma Smith, who's the Professor of Shakespeare Studies at Oxford University, to go along and share an ale or two in the Eastcheap Tavern, and we're delighted that she's here to talk about it with us. Emma, many thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Lucy, and thanks so much for the chance to go and see Player Kings.
Oh, well, not at all. I was actually quite jealous because I love the history plays. I was very intrigued as to what you think about it, which is what we're going to find out.
But why aren't we doing this over an ale or two in the Eastcheap Tavern?
Well, that's a very good question.
Can I just ask?
That is a good question.
I think that's right. I think that would warm things up a bit.
Wouldn't it? We'd be method podcasting then, and I think that would be much better. However, sorry to divert us.
Let's imagine ourselves, mug of ale in hand, or maybe a bit of small beer so that we can keep our wits. So first of all, Emma, this is two plays in one. I've been trying not to call it a mashup, but it's very difficult not to say it. Does that work as an evening?
It's quite a long evening. So clocks in about 3¾ hours. Always ominous when you see a performance that's going to start at 6:30, isn't it?
Yes.
But what Robert Icke has done, which is unusual in these kind of combinations of parts 1 and 2, which have got a long stage history, people have never really thought Henry IV part 1 and 2 really hack it as two complete individual plays. So there's been a long history of putting them together. Mm. And I think Icke's is a really interesting and an intelligent combination, which doesn't do it sequentially, you know, doesn't do most of part one and then a truncated part two as the second bit, but interleaves the parts more creatively to create quite a different arc, actually, for the whole story. So yeah, it works really, really interestingly. And at the very end, spoiler alert, he has brought in the scene from Henry V, where the tavern folks, the Eastcheap folks, talk about the death of Falstaff. So he's incorporated that too into the overall shape.
Oh, so there's a bit of a triple mashup almost.
a smattering. Yeah, I mean, if you were organising the play around Falstaff, which is exactly what everything about this production does, then I guess you want the final bit of the Falstaff story, which is withheld by Shakespeare until Henry V. So it makes sense to bring it back here.
Mm. Well, I was going to ask why, but I think you've just answered why they would do it like that, because there seems to be, and you say in your piece, and you just said, there seems to be a sort of inescapable centre of gravity. There's a figure around which the whole thing revolves. It's all about Falstaff,
yeah,
isn't it?
Completely. It's absolutely all about Falstaff. And it's all about Ian McKellen.
Mm.
And I found it often quite difficult to tell whether the adoration and indulgence and stage dominance and stage presence was brilliant acting or, in a way, not acting at all. Do you know what I mean? Is McKellen absolutely brilliant as Falstaff, or is Falstaff just McKellen? I mean, either way, it's a very compelling central performance, but just as the production is being marketed very much as a star vehicle, and in fact McKellen's recent Shakespeare performances have all been star vehicles, you know, McKellen as Hamlet or McKellen as King Lear, that's very much the case here. And so his star persona combines with Falstaff's physical presence, shall we say, and sort of dominance in terms of the story to create quite a powerful central, as you say, centre of gravity. But I felt a bit overwhelming, perhaps, for the rest of the cast.
Mm. You mean because you sort of felt you were sitting there thinking, I'm watching Ian McKellen the whole time, kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, partly the Falstaff is, you know, Falstaff's such a fascinating character. He's the first Shakespearean character ever to have a book written about him. You know, he sort of inaugurates character study as a way of thinking about Shakespeare. And the moral character of Falstaff has been the question, you know, is Falstaff a coward? Is he a good thing or a bad thing? What kind of influence is he on Hal? Now, in this production, Falstaff is really a very broadly, very lovable figure. And that part of that is Ian McKellen-ness.
Mm.
You know, it's partly an effect. Yeah. It's an effect of casting.
Do you think it's because the audience wants to love Ian McKellen as well?
I think it is. I think it is. And of course, you wouldn't cast Ian McKellen if you wanted the character to seem, you know, or it would be a very challenging bit of casting if you wanted the character to seem a sort of bad agent.
Had Robert Icke cast someone who we just endlessly associate with baddies, you would have watched a completely different production.
You would have watched a completely different production. I mean, if you think about the sort of Gandalf, a Sauron kind of casting in Lord of the Rings, you know, which is one of the things we associate with McKellen now. If you'd cast the bad magician rather than the good one, yeah, your Falstaff would have been a very different character. But as we have it here, and I felt that the way Robert Icke had put those two plays together corroborated this. You have an essentially very sympathetic Falstaff, and not, as I think Shakespeare may be trying to do, not one who gets progressively less sympathetic. One of the reasons that the straight Henry IV part two has always been seen to be in the shadow of part one is that Falstaff doesn't seem quite as funny, quite as captivating, quite as interesting a figure, and also is associated with some behaviours which don't just seem like a man who drinks too much and doesn't pay his bar bill, which is within a certain circle of hell, isn't it? But, you know, somebody who is mustering, there's a scene in part two where he musters these poor half-wit soldiers from Gloucestershire in order to benefit from getting the money for them, and talks about them as food for powder. You know, they're cannon fodder. And it's really quite a low point. That's not a funny fat man. That's a sort of self-interested, dangerous narcissist for whom no one else has any reality.
An operator.
A real operator. And not in a cheeky, chappy way, but in quite a chilling. But we don't get that in this production because of the way that scene is interleaved with the preparations for the Battle of Shrewsbury, which ends Shakespeare's part one. And so this isn't a Falstaff, unlike, I think, Shakespeare's, this isn't a Falstaff who gets less lovable. In fact, you know, because Icke structures this really as a tragedy, you know, a biopic in which the central character dies at the end, which is one definition of a tragedy, you know, he really is the centre of our sort of emotional attention.
But doesn't that do a disservice? I mean, we're talking about both of the levels, aren't we? The characters in the play and also the actors on stage. It's a bit of a disservice to the story itself, isn't it? Because Hal has to be quite a strong, and so does his dad, so does the king. They have to be quite strong characters. I know you say in your piece that that Shakespeare sort of, you know, as you said, he makes him less lovable. And in Henry V, he realises almost that he's got, Falstaff has taken up too much of the audience's kind of love and affection. You've got to switch over to Hal and see how important he is and how he's a character in his own right. I suppose what I'm trying to say is, doesn't this do a bit of a disservice to the other characters and also to the other cast, who seem to me to be excellent? I mean, certainly the other things I've seen them in, they were very, very good.
Absolutely. It's a brilliant star cast, but I do think that there is limited space for those characters and those actors to shine. And we do lose a little bit of the sense of the balance between different competitors for both stage dominance and sort of political dominance. That seems to me what the play is about. It's characters who pop up saying, I'm the most important person here. And that's either through rebellion or through stage charisma or whatever. What happens here is that we lose quite a lot of the energy from those other challenges to the centre of authority in the play. The king, Henry IV, who always has trouble, you know, making much of an impact on his own play. It's one of the great sort of ironies of his reign that he isn't even the central character in the play that has his name. He is paralleled here so cleverly with Falstaff, but is a little bit recessed, I would say, on the stage. The rebels and don't really carry us. It's not. Don't think the player is very interested in that spectacle of rebellion. And Hal himself, you know, there's a big argument about whether Hal is. Why does Hal love Falstaff? Does Hal love Falstaff? What's the grounds of this relationship? And one argument is that Hal is able to be a person with Falstaff that he isn't able to be in the formality and the stuffiness and the expectation of the court. But in fact, in this production, because Falstaff's so all-consuming, there didn't seem a lot of space for skinny Hal to be himself, really, in Eastcheap. What being in Eastcheap seemed to be was to be a straight man to Falstaff's great sort of raconteur sort of stories. So at the moment, you know, it's a very, you know, early in the run, and this is a production that's got a big national tour and lots of opportunities for people to see it, and they may all settle into it a bit more. Maybe the production was a little bit starstruck too, a little bit McKellen starstruck.
I see what you mean, because yes, it's about Hal finding out kind of who he is and how he wants to operate and what he's going to do. But if it's not about Hal, then...
Yeah, and the play begins, the production begins with Henry IV being crowned, you know, taking up the crown and the orb and scepter and, you know, those symbols of authority that we're all much more conscious of now than we would have been, you know, a couple of years ago. And the same sequence happens at the end of the play, of Play Kings, when Henry V, when Hal is crowned. But I don't think there is much expectation from this production about what kind of a king he's going to be. I don't think we are interested. And it made me think about those Shakespearean tragedies, you know, like King Lear or Macbeth or something, where there is somebody, some fresh young person comes in at the end, Fortinbras in Hamlet, or, you know, whoever's talking, Edgar's talking at the end of King Lear, but we don't care about them. The person who's left the stage has turned the lights out, really, as they've gone. And so we don't really care. Nobody thinks, well, I wonder what kind of a King Fortinbras will be for more than a minute. And there was a slight sense of that similar structure here. I didn't think at the end, oh, I wonder if Hal's going to make a good king. I thought, well, we're not really, the spotlight isn't on you. The spotlight is on Falstaff and his decline.
Emma, I wonder, can I ask you that there's another really interesting piece in this Shakespeare issue of the TLS about how people have used and staged the war plays, basically, throughout history to talk to whatever is happening at the time. And sometimes that's for propaganda purposes or jingoism, and sometimes it's perhaps the opposite. But did you get a sense of that in this production, that there was a kind of gesturing towards contemporary feelings and events and resonances?
Surprisingly, you know, I didn't. I feel as if that's sort of the wrong answer, and it may be my obtuseness that didn't see that. I mean, this is a modern dress production. These are soldiers in camouflage and sounds of helicopters and massive ordnance and so on. We know all too well how much that's happening in our world right now. This is not far enough away from us, is it? But it didn't seem to resonate so much with those current conflicts. I suppose what it did suggest is that there isn't really such a thing as heroism. In as much as we saw the battle play out, the Battle of Shrewsbury, in as much as we saw that play out, there were no ways to do that well. And that's quite an interesting take. Falstaff isn't a hero, but actually neither is Hal.
It wasn't really the wrong answer, Emma, because I think I was guilty of leading the witness there, because I got that very much from your review, actually, that was a kind of absence that and perhaps again sort of sacrificed to this star vehicleness, this one characterness of the production.
Yes, I think, you know, that the history, one way of seeing these amazing history plays and one way of presenting them has been as plays where the central character is England. usually England, not Britain, sometimes a slightly larger political unit, but really England. The central character here is most definitely not England or Britain or the UK. It's not a nation. It's not a polis. It's not a political sort of community at all. It's a private one. This is about private individuals. Mm. And so the prominence of the battle and the realism of the battle felt a little bit difficult in the production to quite reconcile with the ways we are seeing and hearing those noises around in the news, you know, every evening.
Because it's not giving that sense that actually what happens in the civic sphere and the political sphere is important and we should care about it.
It's not really giving that, but also nor is it giving, this all seems like a negative, and I suppose it's a negative which produces a different positive. And that's to say, I think this is a play about character, and it's the character it's about is Falstaff. Whereas a different vision of the plays could have been more topical. You know, the history plays have tended to be performed in ways which draw out topicalities and current resonances. That didn't really happen here, although there's an intermittent use of the surtitles, usually to indicate where we are in the country or who's part of the plot we are in. But then there are some slightly longer, more expository titles, including one that takes the place of the character of Rumour, who begins Henry IV Part Two, and we don't get here, but we get a title which says, you know, the royal family have not been seen for ages, and rumour has it, you know, that they are dead. And there was a bit of a ripple of laughter. We all know what rumour does about royals who are not sufficiently in the public eye. But that was very, people were ready to take up the topical, potentially topical allusions, but we didn't really get them. Mm-hmm. And in certain ways, it's actually a slightly old-fashioned production, not too worried about certain kinds of behaviours that maybe the 21st century has made us more conscious of, you know, so it's fine for Doll Tearsheet to sit on Falstaff's knee and be sort of fondled and so on. You know, there's not a problem about that. This is not, Me Too has not reached its cheap, and, you know, people may feel that's all the better for that. It's not worried about those things.
Mm. Is that what you've got a lovely phrase in your piece, the dirty grandpa version?
Yeah.
Dirty grandpa side of Falstaff.
Dirty grandpa. Yeah. I was trying to sort of get across the kind of indulgence, the cultural indulgence there is to people in that kind of position. It's a way of minimizing perhaps the ways they challenge us. But there are other ways. I mean, there's a lovely, really, really lovely sequence in the production where Falstaff is endorsing his own brand of sack in a kind of slightly cheesy TV advert format. It's really brilliant, beautifully, beautifully done. It's very, very funny. And then he gets into a wheelchair. He's wearing his medals and a blazer, and he is in full Captain Tom mode, which listeners will recognise that. I mean, that's to say, lovable veteran, you know, full of spirit, full of stories about the past, you know, greeting everybody warmly, twinkle in the eye, medals flashing. It's a piece where the play sort of forces us maybe, or encourages us to think about our own, how indulgent we might be to this kind of figure, because Falstaff is occupying this position entirely cynically, really.
Yes, he's not raising money for charity, is he, Falstaff? Quite the opposite.
He's not. He's absolutely not raising money for charity. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I just wanted to ask about how the production felt as a whole. I mean, you say it's a long evening. I mean, it kind of has to be if you are going to get both of them in, or kind of what you consider to be the core of both of the plays. How's the direction and the pacing? I mean, did you honestly at some points think, oof, okay, you know, we're 3 hours in? Or is it well-paced and going past a good lick, as it were?
If I'm honest, I think the pacing is not as varied as it might be. And I think there are times when it could crack on a bit. In Shakespeare's Part Two, there are two really lovely characters brought in, Justice Shallow and Justice Silence. And by about sort of 10 to 10, I thought, oh, we're not going to get them. But that's quite a smart piece of cutting, because we don't really want to move location at this point. And then there we are. We're suddenly in Gloucestershire, and we've got a big apple tree dropping apples and some slightly rural sort of indicators, and these beekeepers who come in looking like spacemen, really very, very brilliantly visual, although I'm not quite sure what it meant. But it was a late point to get this new location in. So I felt it had a few moments where it was a little bit long. It was a little bit of an extended concentration. But it's a brilliantly interesting, the script, Ike's script is going to be published, but hasn't yet been. And I'm really looking forward to having a chance to look at the script and to see a bit, because I think there's been some really interesting work integrating those two plays, which for Shakespeare, I think are a blockbuster play and a sequel, an opportunistic sequel. And I think Ike has worked really hard to make them into one long play. So it will be really worth looking at that script.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, so thank you very much. It sounds as though it's like if you love Sir Ian, you got to get down there. It sounds like
you absolutely need to get down there. And if you have a dirty grandpa thing, this is for you.
Or if you just want to see a bit of Shakespeare.
Those I also owe you thanks here, Emma, because last week we were talking about Long Day's Journey into Night, and my main contribution was it's very long, isn't it? So now I feel I'm not alone in sometimes noticing that things could be a little speedier.
Yeah, I mean it's an interesting place we're at in the theatre now, isn't it? That on the one hand we've got 80, 90 minute productions of certain things which are, you know, trying to think about new audiences. We've got this interesting question mark about whether plays should start earlier and people don't want to get home quite so late. And, you know, maybe they would hang around afterwards and chat a bit more if they started at 6:30 rather than 7:30. So there's lots of talk in the industry, I think, about length and audiences. But this is quite a challenge. It's an expensive ticket, though. So if you think about the minutes per pound, I guess that configures the value a bit differently.
Which is not how we think about it, Emma.
It's how Falstaff would have thought about it, though.
Yes, no, that's
it
true,
is. It is. Five gallons of sack and a halfpenny worth of bread.
Yeah, quite right, too. First thing you have to be able to is afford a ticket to get in there. But if you love Sir Ian, that sounds like the thing to do. Emma, thank you so much for joining us.
There's loads to say about it. I'd love to hear from anybody who does go and chat more about it. Thanks ever so much for the chance.
Still to come on the show, Rana Mitter on the changing face of the Tokyo Tribunal.
And to read all the pieces we talk about and much more, remember to subscribe to the TLS. Just head on over to our website at the-tls.co.uk.
And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark. Between 1946 and 1948, Tokyo was the scene of the officially named International Military Tribunal for the Far East, at which 28 Japanese politicians and military officers faced trial for their part in the war that had devastated Asia over many preceding years. The proceedings became more colloquially known as the Tokyo Trial, but were they truly about justice being done, or at least being seen to be done, or a more political and pragmatic affair? Rana Mitter has reviewed a new book on the subject, Judgment at Tokyo by Gary J. Bass, for this week's lead review in the TLS, and joins me now to explain more. Thanks so much, Rana. We really appreciate it.
Alex, it's a huge pleasure to be here with you today.
I mean, what an interesting book to read. And you make the point kind of straight off that this is a mammoth work and that Gary Bass has written about things like the Bangladesh civil war and the US's part in that. But he has brought this immense research to this affair that is not really as well known as, for example, and obviously the Nuremberg trials.
I think that's right. I mean, Gary Bass has form, as you might say, as one of our best, finest chroniclers of what you might call the history of justice, in a sense. The previous book you mentioned, The Blood Telegram, won a lot of prizes, and it's basically about the way in which the United States used highly underhand, illegal means to try and influence what became the Bangladesh Liberation War back in 1971. And that book's well worth a very careful read. But this new one is even more sweeping in scope, and it deals with this two-year-long trial that outside Asia is very rarely remembered. And yet, in a sense, it should be, because it's really, in a sense, not the final word, but at least some sort of capstone on one half of a war which still obsesses us, the Second World War. Even now, you know, 75, 80 years on, we still think about so many of the aspects of that in the European context. But the Asian context still remains a bit shadowy. And for that reason, looking at this set of events when the leaders of Japan were brought to trial, essentially charged with war crimes by a set of judges coming from 11 different countries, all of which had been on the Allied side or were victims, and the judgment, as the title suggests, made at Tokyo after 2 years as to their guilt or innocence. This is a really epochal event in the history of justice, history of World War II, and the history of Asia. And this new book does it full, well, if I may say so, Alex, full justice.
Mm, you go through it in great detail and very enlightening detail. But one of the things that really interested me was that it's there in the subtitle of the book. It's World War II on trial. But as you say, there is a much wider conflict comes into play, doesn't it? I mean, this story starts many, many decades, many years before. But in earnest, I suppose you make the point it's with the invasion of Manchuria in 1931 that this is the kind of scope of the trial.
That's right, Alex. One of the things that I think we all learn, at least in Britain and in the Western world, is that World War II started in 1939, in other words, with the German invasion of Poland. But in fact, if you're from East Asia, that's not true at all. It actually started, depending on how you define it, either 2 years before, in summer of 1937, when Japan invaded China full scale, or if you really want to go back to a pivotal moment, it was on the 18th of September, 1931, when Japanese troops launched a coup that led to the swift but very violent conquest of Manchuria, the northeastern provinces of China. And for that reason, essentially, the war in Asia, the Second World War, looks much longer and more complex than perhaps we've had it in our Western histories. We tend to know about Pearl Harbor, of course, 1941, when the United States is the subject of a surprise attack in Hawaii. Many of its ships are sunk, many are killed. And of course, that launches the US and of course, the British Empire as well into the war against Japan. But the war had been going for years before that. And one of the things that the Tokyo trial did was to examine some of those invasions, atrocities, and other acts by the invading Japanese back in the 1930s, such as the invasion of Manchuria, such as the notorious Rape of Nanking, the Nanjing Massacre, as it's usually known in China these days, when tens, perhaps even more, of thousands of Chinese civilians were killed in the occupation of the then capital city in 1937 to 38. So from an Asian point of view, the war had been going on for most of the 1930s in one form or another. And in a sense, it's Europe and the Western world that comes relatively late to the global war.
It's funny, is the thing that it stirred in my mind in a kind of fictional sense, but I was thinking of Kazuo Ishiguro's novel When We Were Orphans, which is set in that world, isn't it? In that sort of war torn and warring nations, with a sort of European slant on it also, but primarily set there. And it makes the point, that novel, that there is just this sort of ongoing regional issue, regional conflict, which is also so much to do with people's identities and people's notions of themselves as nations. And this seems to come into play into these trials too. It's how countries wanted to see themselves.
I think that's right. If you think about the way in which some of the major Asian countries which are coming into independence during that era thought about their participation in the war, it's very clear that they were talking about something that really mattered for their sense of national identity. So China is perhaps one of the most important actors in that particular drama. China had been invaded, certainly full scale, in 1937. It had been subjected to something like 8 years of war, as they put it, the war of resistance against the Japanese. Many tens of millions killed, hundreds of millions becoming refugees in their own country during that period, and the smashing to pieces of the infrastructure of much of China during that period. So the judge who was sent from Nanjing, the then Chinese capital, a man named Mei Ru'al, who was, by the way, a graduate of Stanford University, was very cosmopolitan. He knew the West as well as the East. This was someone who was looking to make it clear that such an invasion, such a set of crimes against his country, had to be subject to summary international justice. Then there was Jaranila from the Philippines, don't forget, was a colony of the United States during this period. It only gained independence actually during the trial itself in 1946. But because at least one of the most notorious atrocities had taken place in the Philippines during the war, the so-called Bataan Death March, every bit as horrific as it sounds, in 1942, this was something that the Philippines also wanted to make clear that it was seeking retribution for, not just in terms of being a colony of the Americans, but in terms of the suffering of the Filipinos. And then one other interesting example, which Gary Bass writes about in some detail, which was the slightly anomalous case of India. India, of course, was not independent in 1946 when the trial started, but it was independent in 1948 by the time it ended. Nonetheless, one of the judges of the 11 who was placed at Tokyo was a man named Ratha Binod Pal. He was a distinguished jurist, but he took a very different view from the other judges. And while the others all voted to convict either long prison sentences or death sentences on many of the senior Japanese leaders on trial, Ratha Binod Pal made an entirely contrary judgment, a minority dissent, in which he said that all of the defendants should be acquitted of all crimes on the grounds that Japan really had done nothing different from what any of the Western empires had done, in a sense. And this was something that caused a bit of a sensation, as you could imagine, but it was also a sign of an Indian jurist deciding to take an anti-colonial and independent view of what the trial meant.
And it was problematic, wasn't it, as so many of the positions that different judges took within the context of their own, the leaderships in their own countries. So you make the point that Nehru didn't support Pal's view, and that somehow it was, Pal was essentially saying, you must treat Japan as you would treat another country. But he was, you make the point, validating a racist view that China couldn't govern itself.
Yes, in some ways it was very ironic that one of the senior Asian judges was giving the Chinese a hard time for, in effect, saying they weren't running their country well enough in the early 1920s, and therefore it was no one's fault but their own if they got invaded by the Japanese, which is a profoundly contrary sort of way of thinking about it. It sounds a bit like the kind of language that Vladimir Putin sometimes uses for giving, you know, excuses for invading Ukraine. Essentially, it is the case, I mean, I think any historian would acknowledge it, that early 20th century China was highly chaotic. The last emperor had been overthrown at the end of 1911, and a series of essentially militarist warlord leaders were in charge until the establishment of a nationalist government at the end of the 1920s, which even then was relatively weak. So no doubt about the fact that China was not the most stable entity. But one of the things which, again, Powell doesn't really talk about, and which is, I think, needs to be understood, is how much foreign interference in general and Japanese interference in particular undermined the government itself. When you had the Japanese often paying for or supplying or training alternative militarist leaders in parts of northern China in particular, it was very hard to unite the country. And that's one of the things that successive leaders, Chiang Kai-shek for the nationalists, Mao Zedong, Chairman Mao for the communists, all held in common, even though they often hated each other, ending up in a vicious civil war in the 1940s. Both Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong both believed that the expulsion of foreign influence that could essentially change the fate of China without the Chinese themselves having a say, that had to be eliminated. And that's something that Pal, who of course understood British imperialism in India very well, refused to acknowledge in his judgment.
Rana, tell us a little bit about how it was all established, because there are judges from countries all over, from 11 countries, but there is actually a minimal representation of Asian countries. So we've talked about China and the Philippines, but as you say, not Korea, not Indonesia, not Vietnam, not Malaya. How were these hurdles sort of first navigated by, and who was doing the setting up and the saying so?
Yes, initially there were quite a few people, including Supreme Command of Allied Powers for East Asia, Douglas MacArthur, General MacArthur, who weren't actually that keen on having a full-scale trial. A lot of people from many countries thought that the easiest thing would just be to sort of round up Japanese leaders and, you know, either imprison or execute them. But it did emerge quite quickly that essentially the Allied leaders wanted to have some mechanism, some formal system in which it was shown not just that the stronger party could win against the enemy, which they'd finally defeated, but rather that some wider system of justice should be provided. And that's why the courtroom became so important. In a sense, there were parallels, of course, with the much more in the West, famous trials at Nuremberg in the post-war years, when, of course, Nazi war criminals were put on trial. In that sense, part of what it was trying to do was to build one element of what we now think of as the post-war international order. In other words, to build up some kind of international tribunal that would be regarded as an accepted and judicially stable place to assess war crimes or accusations of war crimes and crimes against humanity. In that sense, you can see there's a DNA connection in our own day with the International Criminal Court, with Truth and Reconciliation Commissions in places like South Africa and elsewhere. In other words, the idea that justice should be seen to be done and that it should be more than just retribution. Of course, there were many complaints both at the time and retrospectively that it was so-called victor's justice. In other words, that the judgments made were really the judgments of the side that had won. But I think the act of putting on a trial in the first place, and I think the book argues this quite strongly too, does provide some sense that actually there was desire to do more than simply show the strong win and the weaker lose.
But there was then this I don't, well, who do you put on trial? And so big issue was that Emperor Hirohito was not put on trial, that somehow it was not deemed proper to put a monarch on trial.
Yes, that's probably the biggest decision in the sense of who went on trial and who didn't, that was made in that first year when it was decided who to indict. There were certainly some arguments in favour of the emperor being put on trial on the grounds that all the acts had been committed in his name, and therefore it seemed odd to put on trial the politicians who served him, but not the monarch himself. That said, various figures, including Douglas MacArthur, were very against the idea of putting him on trial, and MacArthur made it clear that he wouldn't permit it. Hirohito also managed to, in a sense, save his own case by arguing that he was just a figurehead, he knew very little about what happened operationally, he was just a sort of rubber stamp. Later research, and I think a certain amount of realisation at the time, showed that that was a bit disingenuous, to put it mildly, that he'd actually had a lot of involvement in imperial conferences. And in the end, it was his word that had forced the war to an end after the dropping of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the Soviet invasion of Manchuria, both of which happened in August 1945. But essentially, the decision of the occupation powers and of MacArthur and the others was that it was necessary to have some sort of symbol around whom the Japanese people could unite, at the same time as completely upending the political system, creating a new, more liberal style of democracy, a peace constitution, which would mean that Japan couldn't go to war again, complete restructuring of the economy. And with all that change, I think the thinking was that having one familiar figure, the emperor, remaining on the throne would create stability in that post-war Japan.
But of course, other really very prominent people did go on trial. Tojo, most obviously, the prime minister, the wartime prime minister.
Yes, there was a selection of war criminals who were, or accused war criminals, I should say, because they were, of course, assumed innocent until proven guilty, although in many cases there wasn't much doubt, I suspect. Class A, the most serious, and then Class B and C, which were regarded as relatively lesser. So Tojo Hideki, the wartime prime minister, one of the wartime prime ministers from 1941 to 44, was certainly put on trial, and essentially much of the blame for decisions on Pearl Harbor and what followed were placed on his shoulders. He was in fact sentenced to death and executed. He was one of several senior leaders who met that fate. That said, there was also a certain amount of, to at least to some observers, unfairness in who was accused. And, you know, that perhaps does suggest there was a certain amount of rough and readiness in these selections. Probably the example that most people would point to as being, or the two that were perhaps least fair in outcome. One was the former foreign minister, Togo Shigenori, who had actually argued quite strongly in the Japanese cabinet against the expansion of the war, but nonetheless was sentenced to 20 years and died in prison in very bad health. And then there were some, you know, intake of breath that Hirota Koki, the former foreign minister of Japan, was also sentenced to death, the only civilian, as opposed to military figure at Tokyo, to meet that fate. That having been said, the weight of evidence that was produced left few people in any doubt that there was, you know, a huge panoply of invasions, atrocities, war crimes that had been carried out by the Japanese Empire during the war, and that the leaders concerned had certainly known about the overall plan, even if you couldn't necessarily pin every single individual atrocity on an order that they had given.
At the end of all of this, I mean, both the trial itself and this re-reading of it, this very detailed look at it, did you come away with the idea that this was a worthwhile enterprise in the sense that perhaps it was the only way that any kind of justice would be done? It was the only available way. Or does it seem too compromised by the various bits of realpolitik that are going on that again become apparent after the event?
I think in the end, you have to be realistic about what was possible. And I think the decision to hold a trial that was public and open and where both sides were given plenty of room to lay out their case, one that acknowledged the importance of legal process as part of what makes, you know, society robust and democratic, and also the chance for voices, even though we're sometimes a bit muffled, but voices from Asia, the region which had been invaded by Japan, from China, from the Philippines, from India, to actually have their say. These were important developments, and they were ones that might not have happened in the same way. They didn't happen in the same way, say, after World War I, in which Asia was involved, but in some ways left far more marginal. Can you point to a whole variety of flaws? Many. I mean, for instance, on the victim side, you know, no one specifically spoke for the Koreans, who were one people who had suffered very badly under Japan. And as I've mentioned, it's also possible to argue that some of the defendants met a harsher fate than perhaps their wartime actions had deserved. But overall, compared to the reality of the alternatives available, which might have just sort of rounding up leaders and shooting them in a yard somewhere, which of course the Soviets, who were involved in the trial on a minority basis, they were very keen on doing this in parts of Eastern Europe. Compared to that sort of summary justice, if you want to call it that, the Tokyo trial looks at least like the effort and the time was taken to try and put forward something that would be exemplary as well as retributive.
Mm. And do you feel, I suppose, the final question really, and a very speculative one, that anything similar could happen now or would indeed be allowed to happen now after a conflict?
I think it's hard to imagine in some ways, though you should never say no. There are institutions such as the International Criminal Court, which are supposed to try and deal with these issues. And there you do find, particularly with various wars that have taken place in sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, that there has been you know, the ability to use those courts to make the case. The example that might come to many minds would be Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. But it seems difficult to imagine that realistically, in the situation that the world is in now, that there's going to be, you know, either a defeat of Russia or the chance for, you know, figures from that regime to essentially be put on trial. It just seems that the power politics means that that's almost impossible, just as, of course, at the end of World War II, the Soviets had also committed horrific atrocities on their territories, but nobody was going to put Stalin on trial for that. So while it's not impossible, as I say, looking perhaps to areas such as conflicts in sub-Saharan Africa might be a good example, if not as high profile in the West as some, for where there has been progress in this area. Overall, it is fair to say that we're probably moving into a period where power may matter more than justice.
Well, Rana, that was so fascinating, not least because, of course, as you point out, in the West, in Western Europe particularly, Nuremberg is almost a byword, isn't it, for what we understand to have happened after a war. And yet the Tokyo trial simply doesn't have that weight in the general consciousness in the same way. But reading your piece, I kind of realised, you know, that there's no reason why it shouldn't do, that it perhaps should have.
I think that's right, Alex, that in some ways, you know, it tends to be less the case in the Western world that examples from Asia are terribly well understood. Perhaps the exceptions will be things like the atomic bombings of Japan. But even so, it's a reminder that many of the issues we often think of as local are very much global. And justice is certainly one of those. And reading Gary Bass's fabulous book, and it really is very, very fine indeed, is a great way to get at not just the history of a particular region, but some universal principles that I think are really worth remembering.
Well, thank you so much for coming to guide us through it, Rana. We really appreciate it.
A huge pleasure, Alex, and hope to do it again sometime soon.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Emma Smith and Rana Mitter.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Charlotte Pardy.
We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, Alex Clark, goodbye.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.